Hello, and welcome to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management, and this is our podcast focused exclusively on all things alternatives. Despite excellent returns in public markets last year, alternative assets continue to get attention due to the income diversification benefits that they provide investors. Together with expensive equity valuations and the potential for above-trend inflation, alternative allocations are expected to continue to rise in the years ahead as they become more widely accessible to the public. This makes the need for general education and thought leadership on alternatives all the more important. That, of course, is the mission of our Guide to Alternatives and this Alternative Realities podcast. And joining me today for this discussion is Aaron Mulvihill, the newest global market strategist on JP Morgan Asset Management's Market Insights team, who will specifically be focused on alternative assets. To start off season two, we're going to discuss some of the implications for alternative assets from policies being proposed by the incoming US administration. Well, Aaron, thank you for joining us here today. So we're very excited to have you join us here in JP Morgan Asset Management.
Thanks, David. I'm very glad to be here.
So before we dive into the topic we're going to discuss today, can you give the audience some information on your background and what brought you to this role?
Sure, yeah. Well, to start with, I'm originally Irish, grew up in Ireland, like yourself, and similarly spent a lot of my life, most of my career, almost all my career actually, outside of Ireland. I had the misfortune of graduating at the same time as the economic crisis was hitting the country, and in terms of job expectations, they weren't great in Ireland, so I was looking abroad. I studied something called European Studies, which is in Dublin, which is the traditional entry point into the diplomatic service or the civil service in Ireland. But after spending a little bit of time with government officials, I decided that was not the career for me. But I had studied, I had a grounding in economics, and I had studied Russian in university, and I decided to give that a go. So I moved to Moscow about 14 years ago now. And I started working with KPMG in M&A advisory at a very interesting time. So advising and helping foreign companies to invest in the growing Russian economy. So did that for a number of years, a lot of M&A transactions and advisory. And then I joined a firm called CRH, which is a major global manufacturer of construction materials and builder of infrastructure. And I joined them in and worked in Eastern Europe, Western Europe, bit of Australia, and moved to the US 5 years ago to work in operating roles in the business. So responsible for finance, running manufacturing plants, and involved in building and improving the businesses and their portfolio companies. So kind of an interesting career, maybe kind of an alternative career in terms of asset management. But after about 12 years of building infrastructure, I'm very excited to help investors navigate the process of investing and creating the investments that enable building infrastructure and real estate and other alternative asset classes.
As I said, very glad to have you join our team. So, the first part of what you're talking about, I'd be fascinated to know, what was it like doing business in Russia?
Yeah, I loved my time in Russia. It was a very different time, right? Challenging to invest there today. It was challenging to invest there even back then, 14 years ago or so. The main challenge, of course, was corruption. As it is in a lot of the emerging markets of the world, and Russia at that time was emerging from obviously communism. The wall fell in the 1990s, and the first generation of companies were owned by Russian nationals who acquired these companies, sometimes through kind of uncertain and murky transactions and so on. And then that second generation, where I was in the 2010s, it was foreign investors starting to invest. So they were struggling with how can we invest in the country in a compliant way. And my work with KPMG was in due diligence, so helping them to understand the assets that they were acquiring, looking at the history of the business, looking at their operations and what they were getting into.
Interesting. So when you were doing due diligence on one of these companies, I mean, what sort of issues were you looking for? What did you find?
Yeah, you're looking at kind of the whole history of the company and how it's operating, and really trying to get comfortable with that business as an investment. We had a lot of I could spend a lot of time talking about the various things we found in these investigations and reports. You know, typically when you carry out a due diligence report, you get a report at the end that has a number of findings, some major and medium and low risk findings. And if you do this in the United States or Western Europe, you might have one or two major items, maybe none. And when we did these investigations in Russia, we would find pages and pages of major findings. It was like reading a thriller. You know, I can give you just kind of one example, maybe a fairly kind of common scenario we would see. We were looking at a bottling plant for a major beverage producer that was interested in investing in the country. And during the diligence, we discovered that they were missing some fairly critical permits required for operations. And this is food and beverage. So you know, there's audits required, there's inspections required. You need to shut down the plant to obtain these permits. So we brought this up to the business management, who said, we've looked for these permits. It looks like you don't have the permit to operate. And where should we go from here? And they said, okay, they looked at what we provided them. They said, yeah, it looks like you're right. We don't have the permits, but check back tomorrow and you'll find the permits there. And sure enough, we checked the next day and you could almost smell the ink on the permits. And you know, situations like that, very challenging for foreign investors to be comfortable with the investment. They needed to have an extremely high risk tolerance, because if it's that easy to obtain a permit, it's also that easy to lose a permit if you upset the wrong business partner. So certainly some investors were able to be very successful in that environment, but ultimately when the war escalated with Ukraine in 2022, many of these businesses that were desperate to just put a flag on the map and have something in Russia ultimately lost their investment.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, obviously in a lot of private businesses, it's good to have an eye for red flags. It seems like you have nothing but red flags in Russia. But so you spent the last 12 years of your life working essentially in infrastructure. Can you talk us through a little bit of what you've learned from all that experience?
Sure. Yeah, I worked with a company called CRH, which is a major global builder of infrastructure and manufacturer of construction products. And so what CRH does is builds roads, highways, bridges, but also underground infrastructure, for example, water networks, waste networks, electricity networks, and quite involved as well in some of kind of the growing spaces we see now, like EVs and data centers and so on. So a fascinating place to be. I really enjoyed the work and the people, some of the most the smartest, hardworking people I've ever worked with. What it taught me, I think, is we take a lot of infrastructure for granted. You know, this is the critical backbone of our economy. It's very easy to forget about it and not think about it, but it's hard stuff to build. I think there's a growing realization today, as we're putting more strain on this infrastructure. We've got a growing population, we've got growing needs, that there is a mounting backlog of investment that's needed to keep it, to make sure that infrastructure keeps pace with our development.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot about, you know, from time to time, over the years, I've heard grumbling about, you know, our infrastructure is it needs to be upgraded and refurbished and grown. But would you say that now is a particularly critical time for us to grow this infrastructure?
I think it is. You know, it's there's been a mounting concern. It's not an unknown thing. I think in certain sectors it's becoming more critical. Like if you look broadly at the state of U.S. infrastructure, there's an organization called the American Society for Civil Engineers, and every 4 years or so they do an assessment on the state of U.S. infrastructure. Last time they assessed it and gave it a report card of C minus. Which is obviously not great. They're going to do that assessment again later this year, I believe. We don't expect that to have improved dramatically. And the challenge is it's a very old system. A lot of it was built in the post-war period. The Eisenhower administration signed the Highway Act in 1956, and a lot of our interstate system was built in the 60s and 70s, similarly with the electricity system. And we've put needs on that system that just were not anticipated at that time. So I
Sure.
think that's being realized now, and there's a need for investment both publicly and certainly privately.
And of course, people tend to, particularly in the public sector, because of budget constraints and so forth, they tend to put it off. But you also would argue that there's a particular need for upgrading the electrical infrastructure system at this stage. Would that be correct?
Yeah, it's interesting. The electrical system, for the last couple of decades, we've really not needed to add significant power generation to the United States, because as the population has grown, we've put more demands on the electrical system, but also our appliances have become more efficient. We're using that power a lot more efficiently, and we're adding to some extent some solar and other kind of off-grid systems that have helped. But we're coming to a point now where there is an investment need, and that's coming from a couple of major areas, right? One is electric vehicles are coming on stream. We can discuss and debate about when exactly that transition is going to happen, but it's moving and it's progressing, and it's going to happen eventually. And another big adder to the demand side on the electrical system is data centers, and particularly AI data centers. So the largest data centers that are being built today consume about a gigawatt of power. That's about the same amount of power that the city of Boston uses. So as we're building these data centers, it's putting enormous strain on the electrical system, and it's an electrical system that's different than it was kind of 20 or 30 years ago, because it's much more distributed. So we've got wind power, and we've got solar power that's added to the system, and it's not kind of small number of large generating plants. Now it's a large number of distributed power plants, and that's a very system. It's very difficult and complex system to manage. Very difficult. Sorry, it's a very different system to manage. And that's what the struggle is today. So there's a massive amount of investment needed in it.
Yeah, and I mean, we've traditionally thought about this as public investment, but there is a big role and a growing role for private investment.
Yeah, certainly. I think the way to think about it is they're public utilities. So they're used by homes and businesses. But in fact, most of the power that's generated and transmitted in the United States is coming from private generators. So what we call investment-owned utilities. So about 70% of US homes and businesses get their power from investment-owned utilities. And so there's a commercial opportunity and obligation that these companies have to grow their power need their power generating and transmission capacity to supply their customers. And they also have a very large base to manage. So if you look at the amount of transmission distribution lines in the United States, there's about 6 million miles of transmission and distribution lines that just need to be managed. And on top of that, now we need to build more capacity to fuel the additional demands we're putting on the system. So there's a massive opportunity there. And like publicly, we've just had obviously the elections not long ago, and in a couple of days we'll have a new administration. Every politician talks about the need to invest in infrastructure, but there's complete unwillingness, of course, to pay for it or to increase taxes. And the incoming administration has pledged to actually reduce public spending overall. So how do we square that circle and add more infrastructure, while at the same time reducing spending? So private investment has to come in and fill that gap. So I think to build the infrastructure we need for the next 50 to 100 years, we're going to need private investment.
And before we get to, one of the things we really want to talk about here is how the policies of the new administration could impact all of this and private markets in general. But on the infrastructure point, I think it is important to recognize that if you've got a company that's supplying power to a certain region or distributing power in a certain region, it's not acceptable for the lights to go off. So there's always a negotiation with the local regulator to make sure that the business is stable and that it's generating reasonable profit. So it is a fairly stable source of income, if you can find a way of growing it smart. So you have to run these companies well. You have to know what you're doing, but it does have the opportunity to provide a relatively stable flow of income.
Absolutely, and we'll probably get to this when we talk about the trade policies coming, but they're a very stable source of income and actually a very good inflation hedge as well, because of the way these businesses, the contracts are set up. They're effectively monopolies, they're regulated monopolies, and their agreements with the local governments and municipalities that allow them to increase their rates, to increase the charges that the customers pay in response to rising costs. And so for investors, that allows them to earn a rate of return that protects them against rising costs and inflation. So they're very effective inflation hedges and very stable investments.
Well, with in a world full of great recent returns, but a fair amount of risk, that sounds very attractive. So let's turn then to politics and the incoming administration. I know we're recording this a few days before the president-elect is inaugurated, but how do you expect policies from the new administration to generally impact alternative investments?
I think the place to start with first is that these are long-term investments. So the policy impacts and changes in rates and tariffs and so on that might happen are likely to have longer-term effects. They don't react as immediately as assets in the public market. That said, there will be impacts from certain policies. And this is kind of a bit of a pre-game discussion here because we don't know exactly what these policies will be. We've heard a lot of proposals and threats and so on the campaign trail, but we can kind of broadly bucket them or bucket what we've heard and what we think may happen into a few categories. Broadly speaking, there's three categories. First would be pro-growth policies that generally will be positive for most assets, including for alternative investments. The second would be policies around trade and tariffs and immigration that are likely to be inflationary if these are actually implemented and not simply threats. And the third would be monetary policies. So how are interest rates going to evolve over the next year or so, and what impacts might other policies have on these? So I think when you bucketed these into these three categories, it gives a framework to think through how these might affect alternative assets.
So let's start with the good news first in terms of policies that might, pro-growth policies, deregulation. When you look at that bucket, what sort of effects do you see?
Yeah, I think a good place to start, and we've seen it in the public markets already, as investors broadly expect two major things to happen. One, taxation to be favorable, which is most likely a continuation of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in some form, potentially additional reductions in taxation, but that's an unknown. At this point, it depends on a lot of negotiation that has to happen within the chambers. And then the second thing would be deregulation. And so to take taxation first, generally that's going to be a positive. It's shown to be a positive in the public markets that we would expect that to flow through to assets like private equity that have similar dynamics and would help their valuations. For the second part, deregulation, that's an unknown at this point. There's been a lot of talk of deregulation. One area where it may have an impact is potentially helping to restart some M&A activity that's been fairly subdued over the last couple of years. There's been a number of large mergers blocked by the Biden administration. We have new appointees in the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission that appear to be, by their voting record, more amenable to large mergers. So that's potentially a positive for M&A. I think private equity generally, if you add in the expectation of lower taxes, the potential restart of M&A, and just the fact that we appear to be in a fairly robust economy, so there's a lot more clarity of around what the next couple of years may hold. So we'd be fairly positive on the outlook for private equity over the next several years.
So that's a good part. As an economist, of course, it's a bit more troubling when we talk about tariffs, and then also potentially, of course, we've had massive immigration in recent years, but potentially deportations or certainly a crackdown on immigration. And sort of how do you think that could affect the space?
Yeah, a lot of uncertainty in this category over what is a threat versus what is likely to be implemented. I think really what it boils down to is these policies have the potential to reignite inflation. So the Fed has been very successful in bringing inflation down towards that 2% level. We would expect it to achieve that level, everything else equal. But if we have a trade war, if we have tariffs enacted on consumer goods, they're likely to affect both consumers and businesses. If we have a crackdown on immigration or reduction in the number of people entering the country, that's likely to raise wages and again stoke inflation. So I think that's the major challenge that investors need to keep in mind over the next several years and making their investment choices is, are they adequately protected for this potential of a restart in inflation?
So obviously we don't know what the extent of this is, and we'll be obviously keeping track of it, and indeed on our website we'll have we're transitioning our election hub into a policy hub, but just for the sake of argument, suppose there is significant inflation going forward, how would that impact various parts of alternatives?
So I think investors looking for inflation protection should look at a couple of assets that have been very effective inflation hedges over time. They've proved this in the recent spike in 2022 and also when you look at longer time periods. And they would be private equity, as we've talked about previously, and has other positive dynamics going forward over the next several years. Very effective inflation hedge. Real estate and infrastructure would be two others. Real estate, of course, the mechanism there is the ability to raise rents as as costs rise. And there's other very, very favorable dynamics right now as well for real estate. I think we're approaching the bottom of the market, or we may have reached or gone past the bottom of the market in areas like commercial real estate that have been fairly depressed over the last several years. I would caution that we would look at core real estate as a particularly attractive area here, because essentially it kind of comes back again to the clarity question. We have more clarity on real estate now because we've had several years after COVID to understand how do people work and live and play. And so the offices today that are reasonably well occupied are likely to be well occupied in time. They're the ones that are well located and have amenities and so on. And these will prove to be very good investments, very stable and effective inflation hedges. There are offices that are not occupied today and probably will not be occupied because they're in the wrong locations. They don't have the amenities and so on. So I think investors need to be selective, but broadly, real estate can be a very effective inflation hedge. Infrastructure also, as we talked about before, there's the ability for utility companies to raise rates in response to higher costs, and that makes it very effective in an environment of increasing inflation.
Okay, so along with higher inflation, if we have it, of course, comes the threat of higher interest rates. I mean, both because higher inflation means higher long-term rates anyway, and then also because the Federal Reserve might be less willing to cut rates. So when you look at the asset alternatives as an asset class, how do you think about higher interest rates and higher for longer?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and that's maybe what we'll end up with if the Fed stops their easing cycle at the end of this year. Rates that are higher than at any point we've experienced in the recent memory for a longer time period. And I think it depends on each asset class. There's going to be different dynamics. If we take private equity, for example, the challenge in private equity is financial leverage is not a lever that they have anymore, right? They're going to be more reliant on operational excellence to drive returns. And we're already seeing this since 2022. Private equity firms are holding companies for longer because when the rates rose at that time, they weren't able to exit at the same multiples that they entered these investments with. So I think we'll see that the managers who have a proven track record of operational improvements in their business will tend to outperform in this environment because that's how they need to drive returns. Other asset classes you could think about would be private credit, for example. These are typically floating rates, so as interest rates are higher, that's good for investors. But we also have to think about credit risk and when did the borrowers take out these arrangements? Were they expecting rates to continue to go down further? So in these cases, there may be some default risk to be mindful of. But I think generally speaking, it's probably going to be positive for that sector. Another one that we would look at is hedge funds. So hedge funds generally, in a period that we're entering now, where we're going to have more tweets, more news stories, more volatility, that leads to mispricing, and that's generally a target-rich environment for hedge funds. But another benefit that they will have with higher rates is they're taking long and short positions on views. As they take short positions, they're required to post cash collateral, and they earn interest on that cash. So in an environment of higher interest rates, all else equal, they'll generate better returns from that dynamic. So
So,
I think, yeah,
yeah.
pardon me,
So,
yes.
so, so, in, so, in summary, I mean, higher rates sound like they should be good for hedge funds because it's basically cash yields plus alpha. So, if cash yields are more positive, that should help. But when
Indeed.
it comes to private equity and private credit, it sounds like this is a time when really doing that diligence is going to be really important. It sort of brings you back to, I guess, the start of your career. I mean, you're going to have to really look at these companies carefully. You're going to have good managers to look at these companies carefully to make sure that you're really buying people who are great operators, not just great financial engineers.
Absolutely. Asset selection is always key. It's a lot easier to make money when rates are low and when rates are higher. That discipline and picking the right underlying companies in portfolios, companies that will outperform in any market environment, I think that's critical. So it's the managers that are focused on asset selection, asset improvement over time that will tend to outperform in this environment.
So, Aaron, any final takeaways?
Yeah, I think whatever happens in terms of policies, it's definitely going to be a volatile environment over the next potentially 4 years. But if you put the policies aside, economically, the fundamentals are quite good. And there's quite good fundamentals in terms of the dynamics in various alternative asset classes. So I think it's an environment that investors should be invested in, ideally fully invested. And as we've had high public market returns over the last couple of years, this is probably the time to take a look at the portfolio, take a look at asset allocation, and consider the role that alternatives could play in that.
Yeah, no, I think that's very good advice. This is it. Last 2 years have all been about return, and there is risk out there too. And one of the ways of dealing with risk is just to have a more diversified portfolio. And I think alternatives are increasingly going to be part of that. And so I think Aaron, as our new alternative strategist, you're going to be busy over the next few years. But again, we're very glad to have you as part of our team. And thank you for joining us on this podcast. And thank you all for joining us here on Alternative Realities.
Thank you very much, David.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.